Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Written in 1941 in wartime Britain, C.S. Lewis's The Screwtape Letters has been a longtime favorite in a long list of literary temptation stories over the years. But Lewis's views of temptation is less about pure evil than of sloth, indolence, materialism, the idea of doing nothing rather than trying to improve one's life and the world around us. Something we can all relate to. Lewis's epistolary book of missives, from his abysmal sublimity Screwtape to an apprentice demon Wordwood, formed the basis of the book, and it's about how to corrupt and damn the, quote, patient, unquote. And the story's been adapted to the stage by my guest today, Max McLean. McLean is a principal of the Fellowship for the Performing Arts, a Christian-based entertainment group out of New York City that has performed and toured the Screwtape Letters for the past 4 years to great critical acclaim, including a 9-month run off-Broadway. McLean is the co-adapter of the piece and producer-director for the production. He actually originated the role of Screwtape. His group will present the national tour of the Screwtape Letters Saturday at 4 and 8 o'clock at the Broken Arrow Performing Arts Center. And portraying Screwtape at these performances will be Brent Harris, who most recently was Scar in the national touring company of The Lion King. The Screwtape Letters, again, this Saturday at the Broken Arrow Performing Arts Center, and Max McLean is my guest today, joining us by phone. Max McLean, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rich.
This is a very interesting project you've been involved with. How did you get the idea of adapting the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis for the stage? Because mainly when you read them, it reads almost like a monologue, which could be a single actor, but really creating a whole stage production.
Yes. Well, Lewis certainly did not write the Screwtape Letters for the theater. The way the project came to me was I was working on another show at a small professional theater in New Jersey, and this theater professor from Drew University in Madison, New Jersey, saw it, and I didn't know his name was Jeff Fisk, and I didn't know him. A couple of weeks later, he sent me an email and told me how much he appreciated the work, and in the body of the text, he suggested that I would make a really good Screwtape. And that really caught me by surprise. First of all, I didn't know if it was a compliment or not, given who Screwtape is. I had read the book. I was intrigued, but I did not see it as theatrical literature. But he had an idea how to do it. And I said, well, if we can get the rights from the C.S. Lewis estate, we would have a go of it, because I had read the book in my 20s, and it had a very profound impact on me. So I thought, let's see what could happen. And that's how the project began.
Give us a sense of what it was like to translate this work, which again is an epistolary form. Yeah. Where he's basically sending a letter after mm-hmm. letter from himself to his apprentice demon Wormwood on how to ruin the life of an unsuspecting human on Earth. How did you set about adapting it? Because it's not a one-person show, it's a two-person show.
That's right. Well, the one thing I do recall when I read the book, and I think it was probably the reason why I did think that it had some merit theatrically, was that in my recollection of reading the book, I could hear the voice. It's a rather insidious voice. It's a pleasant voice, the narrator in the book, Screwtape, and yet it's a voice that you like listening to, but then you don't like what it's saying. And so it has all these conflicting ideas going through your head that I think is really interesting theatrically. And then two other things that I thought made it compelling to at least attempt a theatrical adaptation. One is, I do think that the book is one of the best examples of reverse psychology in all of literature. Lewis had the audacity and the brilliance to create this morally inverted universe where up is down, good is bad, God is called the enemy, Satan is called our father below, and to be able to sustain it from beginning to end is just quite a feat and quite an act of genius. And secondly, I think the character that he wrote, Screwtape, is one of the great literary creations of the 20th century. I mean, he's so smart. He's so good at his job, so confident. He's this master of the universe character who who loves the way he looks, loves the way he talks, loves the way he dresses, smartest guy in the room. He's just pure pride. And so that is the stuff of great leading characters for theater. So I thought all that you had going for it. Then the next question is, what is the story arc that would hold an audience's attention? And actually, we found two that were actually quite compelling. They weren't obvious, and most people that read the book probably don't think of it that way. They mostly think of it as a kind of reverse devotional.
Right, right. Because everything, all the nomenclature is his, you know, the enemy is God. So it's not a hierarchy, it's a lowerarchy.
It's a lowerarchy, that's right. And at first it's like, wow, what's he talking about? But once you make the switch, it's amazing what recesses it opens up in your mind. You know, because you hear, you know, if you hear the stuff, quote unquote, straight, you say, yeah, I've heard that before. I understand. Yes, you're right. Of course. And then you kind of move on, but your imagination is not engaged. It's just, you know, it's another sort of precept, you know, another sort of teaching. But to hear it the other way around, it's like, huh. You know, this guy really wants me to do that? and then all of a sudden, you know, your imagination is like, huh? And you really get brought into the story. And then, of course, the story is, it's a basic story. It's a hunt story. Screwtape is a predator. The patient, this unsuspecting human on Earth, is the prey. Wormwood is Screwtape's accomplice in this crime. And so we follow two story arcs that make the play interesting is what happens to the patient who, in my view, is modeled after Lewis himself. Mm-hmm. You know, he's actually expressing, you know, his own bouts with temptation in the story and how easy he falls. So what happens to the patient who begins the story as essentially indifferent to spiritual things. And then by the end of the story, he's become quite devout. And this in spite of all the efforts of Screwtape to ruin him. And then the more theatrical arc of the story is what happens to Screwtape, who I mentioned earlier, starts the story as this master of the universe character, you know, really on top of his game and so proud, so confident. And then by the end of the story, he's defeated. And that's really interesting to watch this, you know, this proud man fall.
Yeah.
And so that's what makes the story compelling dramatically.
Increasingly desperate in a way.
Increasingly desperate, that's right.
And the one thing that's really interesting about this piece, as opposed to other sort of temptation stories or selling your soul to the devil, whether it's Don Giovanni or Faust, is in this case, Screwtape is not asking for real evil. He's really asking for more like the seven deadly sins, if you will. You know, sloth, not doing things. And I think that's one of the interesting things about the book and the stories is that he's not asking for the patient to become evil. He's just asking him not to be good.
Yeah, and his boy, that's a really interesting thought. There's so many ways to respond to that question. I think one of the most salient moments in the piece is Screwtape says the safest road to hell is the gradual one, the gentle slope, soft underfoot, without milestones or signposts. And he says that in response to Wormwood, who does want to report spectacular sins, whether they be murder or rape or some kind of awful sin. But no, he says, that's not the best way to do this. Just go slow and easy. And I think that's also one of the geniuses of Lewis, is that he makes our decision-making, the, you know, our day-to-day, moment-to-moment decision-making, an arena of cosmic proportions. That, you know, the choice you make in this moment to do this or that is going to affect maybe not just the rest of that afternoon or that day or that week. It could have eternal consequences.
There's also this thread that runs through the piece, which involves how modern life has changed, you know, religion, and how finding the Creator or finding, you know, salvation, the modern life becomes, you know, it offers creature comforts, and so it makes what seems, in the course of C.S. Lewis's perspective, what is a very simple decision more complex. And Screwtape was always encouraging that complexity. It's just, you know, I think there's a one passage of a letter in which he says, you know, I once had a patient where he was sitting in a library finding God, and he said, all I had to do is said, instead of following up on this idea of following God, go to lunch. Think about it after lunch. And he says it gets him out of the real world, and the real world immediately will erase any idea of godliness and following God. And I thought that was really interesting. It's a very interesting perspective of how he views contemporary life, and that contemporary life sort of leads you away from spiritual matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he has many, many wonderful lines like that. He says, at some point, the long, dull, monotonous years of middle age are excellent campaigning weather.
That's great. Well, now, in your particular production, it is a two-person production. There's
That's right.
Wormtail and
Toadpipe.
Toadpipe. It's been a while since I've looked at this. So is Toadpipe mentioned in the letters, in the actual C.S. Lewis?
Yes. Yeah, okay. there's a point in is mentioned once as Screwtape's secretary. And, of course, when we were designing the piece, we knew that we didn't want Screwtape sitting behind a desk writing letters. So we said, okay, let's give him free rein to do whatever he wants to do dramatically. And then we did notice this Toadpipe character as his secretary. He says, let's have the secretary manage all the letters, because it is called the Screwtape Letters. It is about communication from hell to earth. And so we wanted to be true to the conceit of the book, which and letter writing was Lewis's preferred way to get, you know, his genius on paper. So we wanted to give Lewis free rein to do what he did. And then Toadpipe would handle all the letter management in very, very humorous ways. We have a fabulous set that conveys this, including some kind of pneumatic device that sends all the letters from hell to earth and gets them back. And in fact, one of the DC papers mentioned in their review that hell has to have one of those, which I thought was great.
The old pneumatic tube device that the old department stores used to have. Yeah, right, exactly.
That's right. So, and it would go up and down. So we have that. And then in the book, Screwtape mentions a lot of characters that are unseen, and he talks about these characters that could impinge on the patient's life and have impinged on the patient's life. And so in our play, Toadpipe has this ability to morph into these characters at the flip of a finger and then morph back out, which is humorous and really helps articulate what Screwtape is saying.
Now, nonetheless, whoever plays Screwtape, and that's been you for many years, and now it's Brent Harris,
right.
There has to be an awful lot of dialogue. I mean, it's basically a 90-minute piece, tour de force.
Yeah, it's 90 minutes. It's two-person. The language is unbelievably entertaining to say as an actor. You know, it's so much fun to play a character that is so much smarter than you, who speaks so much, who has a vocabulary and can deliver sentences that are just so elaborate and so fun to listen to. And, you know, he loves the sound of his own voice, and he loves putting these strings of perfect prose together. So from an actor's perspective, you know, it's almost like top of the, you know, climbing Mount Everest. And if you succeed, it's really a tremendous experience. And Brent has, he joined the company in January. His first production was at the Shakespeare Theater in Washington with us. Prior to that, he had played Scar in Walt Disney's The Lion King. He just finished that and joined us. So he has, and Scar, of course, is the bad lion, the screw tape of that story.
Right. When I'm looking at his credits, he's done Lucifer and Dr. Faustus. And so, yeah, he specializes in this, doesn't he? Well, let me remind folks, my guest today is Max MacLean, the producer and director of the theatrical adaptation of C.S. Lewis's The Screwtape Letters, which he helped adapt. It will be appearing Saturday at 4 and 8 o'clock at the Broken Arrow Performing Arts Center for two performances. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, now, you originated this role, and you did it for, I guess, about 3 or 4 years, or maybe even a little longer. Watching Brent take it over, what was really interesting about that process? I would assume being the director and originating the role, that must have been an interesting process to watch.
Well, I mean, Brent was such a committed actor and committed to the role. The process of taking over a role, which is a pretty common process in the business, the role has been created, so the actor that takes it over has to learn the role as played, and then of course his personality, his voice type, his body type impacts how he does that. So it is certainly Brent's own role, but he is attacking each scene at pretty much the way we had created it over the course of the 9-month run in New York and the 2 years of touring prior to Brent joining the tour this year.
Now, you did tour this piece extensively before you went to New York and had a 9-month run in New York and was very successful. Did you have to retool anything as you saw it before audiences when the production first?
Yeah, well, we did. We ran the show. We originated the show in New York in a small theater. Then we took it to Chicago for 6 months. And we were in D.C. for 10 weeks. Then we toured it briefly in 2009 and then brought it to New York in March of 2010. And the difference between the 2009 tour is what we learned in the 2009 tour, and recognizing that when you come to New York, you do have to step up your game. So we went back into the rethought some moments, clarified some moments, and I think we have a much sharper, clearer show than we had prior to the two, once we got to New York.
Well, I'm going to ask about your organization a little bit. This is produced by the Fellowship for the Performing Arts, which is a Christian-based theatrical organization. I was reading some of your material, and you said, Christians have given up on theater for the most part, and you felt like this was an attempt to be a part of this very important moving artistic medium from that Christian viewpoint. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, our mission is to produce theater from a Christian worldview that has the ability to engage a diverse audience. There's certainly been a lot of Christian themes in theater, and a lot of Shakespeare's work was certainly based on the assumption of a Christian worldview. But more recently, that seems to have been lost, and so there's much more of a I want to say nihilistic, more hopeless worldview than the Christian worldview offers.
Other would say diverse,
which is diverse. Yes. But there's a real sense of artists see artists are pretty are if you're good you're authentic, and it's pretty hard to sugarcoat things because the universe can be pretty terrifying, and it can be unforgiving, and we humans feel the weight of that. And so if you don't have a worldview of a world beyond this natural world, that there's another world, then it becomes hopeless. And so I do think that the Christian worldview has an opportunity to respond to that.
I think the interesting thing about the Screwtape letters is that you can read it from a Christian viewpoint, or you can read it from a humanistic viewpoint and still find material there that speaks to you.
I think that's right. And that's probably a testimony to Lewis, because Lewis's own journey, spiritual journey, he went from atheism to paganism, dabbled in the occult a little bit. Then he, as a philosophy student at Oxford, became enamored with philosophical theism, mostly under Berkeley. From there, but the God of the philosophers didn't ask him to do anything. As he says in his autobiography, it would be up there. It would never come down here and make a nuisance of itself. And from there, he went to full-orbed theism, and then finally Christianity. And that process took him almost 7 or 8 years. And so when you read Lewis, all of those viewpoints really come into play. And that's why I do think, as you said, you don't have to be read him from a Christian worldview.
Now, one last question. I know you did this role for 4 years. Was there a mm-hmm. point in the show that you always look forward to, like a particular point? I mean, I know it's you have to be of the moment as you're doing the role, but as you look back, is there a particular point in the play that you can maybe describe for us that sort of sums up the challenge of doing Screwtape?
Well, there's lots of those. I think the fun moment is when you are experiencing the audience where their silence is rather deafening, where they're in the imagination of the moment and living that moment the same way you are. And of course, as an actor, you can't get outside that moment and observe it. You can only think about it after the fact and look back on it and how wonderful it was. But that's the joy of the theater, is providing the audience that kind of suspension. And, you know, and when audiences come from whatever they come from, you know, when they walk through the doors of the theater, they're bringing their world with them. And to be able to take them out of that world for the 2 hours traffic of our play is the highlight of our work.
Do you, in those silences, do you feel like you're feeling them thinking about this piece?
The silences are, there's so much going on in those silences. It's interesting about audiences, because there becomes a kind, when theater is working at its best, there becomes this kind of mind meld where the audience becomes one singular mind, and they're all experiencing this moment together. And the power of that, the actor definitely feels.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with the Screwtape letters. Saturday at 4 and 8 at the Broken Arrow Performing Arts Center. Max McLean, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Max McLean is the artistic director of the Fellowship for the Performing Arts, the co-adapter, producer, and director of the national tour of the Screwtape Letters, based on the book by C.S. Lewis, which will be performed Saturday, October 5th at 4 and 8 o'clock at the Broken Arrow Performing Arts Center. For information, visit screwtapeonstage.com. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Barry Friedman.
A Daughter Goes to Oregon, Part 2. Vegas, baby. Just arrived in Las Vegas at my father's 9 minutes ago. He turns the television down to human level. We'll be here for 5 meals. They've all been scheduled. Only problem, one of the buffet coupons is only good tomorrow from 2 to 4, which means we'll be having dinner at 3:30 in the afternoon. There's simply no other way to make this work. At the Suncoast Casino, there's a Neil Diamond impersonator and something called the Jewish Repertory Theater of Nevada doing the show Love Letters. I think about my relatives. If they ever wrote letters, it would go something like this. Old Jewish husband, go to hell. Old Jewish wife, kiss my ass. Ta-da! Wednesday. We're not traveling today. Nina wants to go to the Strip, buy souvenirs. First buffet of the day is almost finished. Nina's going back for the Eggs Benedict. My father's trying to maneuver the cereal box and the milk into the little bowl. Some moments are perfect. She's good with her grandfather. His toupee is curly. We drop him off at the MGM to play craps. We head to New York, New York Casino. Will I lose father points, I ask, if I don't go on the roller coaster with you? Not at all, she says, but you'd gain a bunch if you did. I go on the roller coaster. I show her where I used to do comedy, where I spent the only afternoon I can remember drinking and getting drunk. She remembers coming here with me when she was little, with her brother, and drinking virgin daiquiris in the room at the Maxim Hotel. Later that night, on the way to dinner, Nina asks her grandfather, are we going to another buffet? Of course, he says. Oh, God, she responds. Now, any notion that I had that I was James Bond when I'm in Vegas at the Baccarat table drinking a martini was dispelled when I found myself playing bingo across from a woman eating a sandwich she had brought from home. Dad, Nina said at one point, I think you stole her dapper. I won $54, but the bingo mistress, or whatever she's called, told me I was dabbing incorrectly. At night, Nina takes the sofa, gives me the guest room. Thursday. We stop for bagels, again, six of them this time, on the way out of town. In Tonopah, Nevada, we see another Ron Paul sign. I know the dream dies hard, but damn, this is getting ridiculous. The police aren't getting back together either. The road to Reno is deserted. If the car breaks down, we'll be skeletons before anyone finds us. Nina falls asleep. She rests her head on my shoulder. It's uncomfortable, but it's one of those perfect moments again. Now, to the woman doing the voiceover on MapQuest, tell me one more time, stay right to 395 North, and I swear to Rand McNally I'm putting this car in a ditch. It starts to rain. The wind picks up. Visibility is getting worse. We stop at a gas station that's closed in a town with no name in Northern California, but the pumps are still open. $4.69 per gallon. Because we can, Nina says, seeing the price. We take turns going out back to pee. Interstate 5, while only 89 miles away, seems forever. It's really raining. The fog is really bad. There are no lights. Nina is now 24, the same age Paul was when he died, and when she laughs or says, Dad, the two greatest sounds I've ever known, she sounds like her brother. And for that moment, in a packed Toyota Echo heading west and north, I hear him. I hear her. We're all together.
Barry Friedman is a writer, essayist, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.